In the hospital where I work, all of the isolation rooms are already full, so we're putting COVID patients anywhere there's a bed.
As the number of COVID-19 cases rises, hospitals are stretched thin and underprepared for this pandemic.
We were all gathered 2 weeks ago and said, our job descriptions no longer apply. We have to avoid a situation like what developed in Italy. And, you know, we were told to essentially work miracles in days.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Monday, March 23rd, and I'm Duarte Geraldino. Also on the show, how sex workers around the U.S. are dealing with the crisis.
A lot of the work that sex workers do is intimate work, and with intimacy kind of being out of the equation right now, that leaves so many sex workers out of work.
Busy show. Let's get going. Like millions of people in the U.S. right now, I'm working from home. Yes, broadcasting from my New York City apartment. So if you hear a truck roll through or a siren or my infant twins in the background, it's not your imagination. No, it's just one more sign of the times that we're living in. A small but brave portion of our crew is in the studio today. The rest of our team is producing from home. We're here for you in every way we can be. So let's start with you.
Hi, this is Shelley from North Andover. I'm an RN on a medical surgical unit that's been designated as our local hospital's COVID-19 unit. I haven't been there for over a week as I've had symptoms and I'm awaiting test results. It's difficult on so many levels, between isolating and feeling like I should be helping my community and wondering if sitting on my couch is the best thing I can be doing for my community. I'm a doer. Not getting things done hurts more than my chest from all this coughing. Thanks, Takeaway.
Healthcare workers are on the front lines in the fight against COVID-19. Now, we've already seen hospitals in countries like Italy and China being overwhelmed by an explosion of COVID-19 cases. Experts say it's only a matter of time before the same happens here in the U.S. Already, healthcare workers are sounding the alarm about our country's severe equipment shortages, warning us that depending on where you live, you or someone you know may not have access to life-saving equipment when you need it. Everything from ventilators to the masks that protect healthcare workers are in short supply. And this is really important because tough choices are going to have to be made as COVID-19 spreads. Healthcare workers may be forced to ration supplies and decide which patients to treat given their chances of survival. In the coming days and weeks, we'll be checking in with healthcare workers across the country. Doctors, nurses, lab technicians, orderlies, all the people that help our system operate, you name it. But today, we're going to start with two people on the front lines in Boston and New York City, respectively. Two cities in the thick of it. Dr. Daniel Horn is a physician at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's helping lead the hospital's COVID-19 preparedness efforts, specifically for telemedicine and primary care. Dr. Horn, thanks for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Danielle Ofri. She's an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital and a clinical professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine. She's also the author of When We Do Harm, A Doctor Confronts Medical Error. Dr. Ofri, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Ofri, how is your hospital preparing for COVID-19? What are you seeing so far?
Well, our hospital has changed, as all hospitals, practically overnight. Like Dr. Horn, I'm a primary care doctor and mainly outpatient, and we have a busting at the seams medical clinic typically. Overnight this week, we turned it all into phone visits, so no patients coming into our clinic. And then we erected a COVID tent out in the courtyard, and so that's where we're doing all of our COVID testing, as well as starting to do triage there as well.
What does a telemedicine visit look like? Can it be applied for all visits or just a significant portion?
Well, we're trying to do for all. I mean, clearly there may be a few that require, video, maybe, for rashes, things like that. And there may be things that are physical, surgical wounds that need to be examined. But right now we're attempting to do everything by telephone.
Dr. Horn, what about you? What's happening at Mass General?
Overall, we're doing really well, and we stopped all elective procedures, cleared out all possible inpatient capacity. We've also closed down most of our in-person primary care, remaining open simply for patients with, urgent needs that otherwise may end up in the emergency department, so we want to avoid that. We've opened up respiratory illness clinics, which are dedicated clinics to care for people with, flu-like illness or coughs and colds that could be COVID, to sort of remove that population into a dedicated clinical management area so we can learn really quickly how to best manage these patients and create an opportunity for patients to be seen in a clinic without going to the emergency room in a panic. We were all gathered 2 weeks ago and said, our job descriptions no longer apply. We have to avoid a situation like what developed in Italy. And, you know, we were told to essentially work miracles in days.
What are some of the biggest concerns and lessons that we can learn from what's happening right now?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing is that we are all operating at light speed to get the health system prepared. And we're relying on collective society to engage in comprehensive social distancing and really take those seriously. Staying at home, not even small group gatherings, very aggressive hand hygiene. And, you know, if you have a flu-like illness right now and you're under 70, don't have shortness of breath, don't have things like immunocompromised conditions, you should not come to a clinic. You should call your healthcare professional and get advice. Every state is in a different position around testing right now. So you should stay home, read the CDC's website on self-care and self-quarantine, and speak to a medical professional before you come in.
What are the biggest concerns for healthcare workers right now? Not just the physicians like yourself, but all the other people, the nurses, the lab techs, the orderlies, everyone who makes your system work. What are their biggest concerns right now?
I think the big concerns are how to protect our healthcare workers, and Mass General and all of Partners Healthcare, our sort of parent organization as of today, has asked that all healthcare workers wear a mask, sort of as they're in clinical environments morning to night. And that is a real relief for our healthcare workers. That's to protect healthcare workers and patients. We are relieved that our healthcare workers will start wearing masks all day in the clinical environment.
Dr. Ofri, many healthcare workers, it seems like they are bound to get COVID-19 themselves. When those workers are out of commission, what does that mean for the healthcare of patients?
Well, yes, we expect a good percentage at some point to be out. And right now, the criteria are very strict. We check our temperature twice a day. If you have 100.0 or the slightest sore throat, cough, or anything, you are out for 7 days. And so that is a big chunk of people for a big chunk of time. Now, some of those folks may be able to work from home. Again, televisits luckily can be done from home, but some will be ill and not able to work. So we're preparing for large percentage of our workforce being out. So right now we've been shifting doctors and nurses all over the place. Outpatient doctors are now going inpatient. We're shifting, you know, surgical staff to non-surgical areas, wherever, you know, it needs. And I think people are expected to work in different positions, but we could be short-staffed in a way that we haven't experienced with prior healthcare crises.
So some cities like New York City are calling on retired healthcare workers to make themselves available. Should we expect that to help address the workforce shortage or not?
I think it can. I mean, certainly someone retired can't walk into an ICU, but they can, you know, answer a hotline and help triage triage patients who are calling. They can also help answer questions from residents and house staff. So there's many things that retired healthcare workers can do.
How does the COVID-19 crisis itself compare to other public health crises that you've seen play out at Bellevue Hospital, New York City? In particular, I'm talking about the AIDS crisis in the 90s or more recently, Ebola.
Honestly, when Ebola came, we didn't know what the degree would be, and we prepared as though it would be the pandemic that we're seeing now with COVID. So Ebola, we certainly ramped up to quite a degree. In the end, it was smaller than we expected, but the amount of work it took to even handle, we had one Ebola patient at Bellevue. It was an enormous amount of work. With AIDS, we operate in the dark for longer. We did not know for many years what we were facing and what the outcome would be. But one crucial difference in all the years, and I trained during the height of the AIDS epidemic, we never once thought about running out of equipment, you know, masks and gloves and gowns. That worry, it just never dawned on us that we might run out. And that's really a new thing.
So much seems to have to change operationally, Dr. Horn. Now, this pandemic is also raising ethical questions about access to care and, to be frank, the difficult decisions that doctors have to make when it comes to who gets care and who doesn't, like we've seen in Italy. Is this something you and your hospital are thinking about right now?
I am thinking about it more from a national perspective. I think we're going to see isolated ventilator shortages at hospitals. And I yesterday wrote a piece in the New York Times that calls for rapid solutions to three problems around potential ventilator shortages: construction, distribution, and operation. We need a transparent and clear plan immediately to address this. The American public deserves to know how this is going to be handled. We need to use the Defense Production Act to compel industry to build ventilators or to build creative solutions to multiply ventilators to care for multiple patients at once. We also need to understand how this scarce resource will be allocated. And the sooner communication starts about this, the better.
So we've seen the hospitals in Italy and China be completely overwhelmed. How close are we to that point right now, as of today?
Because we don't have mass testing, it is hard to know. And some projections still say we are in various cities only 2 to 3 weeks behind places like Italy. And that is concerning. Without mass testing, we don't know the answer. And we are very hopeful. And I would simply say that whatever time we're buying now, there needs to be swift action to anticipate things like equipment shortages, ventilator shortages, blood bank shortages. We can predict in healthcare to some degree what is coming. We just need to be heard.
You know, you are not just experts in this field, but you're actually going through it, the both of you. How is it affecting you? How are you dealing with it on a very, very personal level? Dr. Afri, can we start with you?
I think for most of us, we're just trying to stay focused, you know, putting one foot in front of the other. You know, so many patients, every patient that I've swabbed in the last week and a half, is they've been incredibly grateful and thank you for your service. And part of me feels not prepared to take that praise, not service. This is our job, and that's what we want to do. We really want to do it well. And I think, you know, as I think a lot about patient safety and medical error, one thing the situation may put us in the place of being is not being as rigorous as we'd want to be if we're short on protective equipment and having to cut corners and having to do substandard medicine. That's terribly corrosive to doctors and nurses who really want to do the right thing. And so I worry about that. But really, this is what we're supposed to be doing. And I feel like there's been no question. The esprit de corps has been excellent. Everyone is volunteering. People are being incredibly gracious, covering for each other, stepping in where needed. I mean, every day our schedules and our lives completely change. You'll be here, you'll be there. And I was like, no problem, just tell me where to go. But, you know, it could get worse, obviously. For the moment, I think we're just going to work as usual and keeping it going.
This will be a drawn-out experience. And we need to consider the mental health of our healthcare workers. We also need to consider the mental health of our nation over the coming year.
Dr. Daniel Horn is a physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, and Dr. Danielle Ofri is an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital. She's a clinical professor of medicine at NYU School of Medicine and also author of When We Do Harm, A Doctor Confronts Medical Error. Thank you both for joining us, and we'll be keeping you and your colleagues in our thoughts during this time.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you.
My name is Matt. I'm a registered nurse, and I work in an ICU in Seattle. In the hospital where I work, all of the isolation rooms are already full, so we're putting COVID patients anywhere there's a bed. We're still short of personal protective equipment. We're being told to reuse masks and other gear in between patients. There still isn't enough testing capacity, and the turnaround time on the tests that are being done is 2 to 3 days, which means that we end up wasting scarce resources on patients that test negative for the virus. Federal government and the management of my hospital still look like they're completely flat-footed.
You have likely heard some of your friends, neighbors, family members talking about getting out of dense areas like major cities in reaction to the spread of the virus. But where are you going to go? Hospitals in rural areas, just like hospitals in big cities, are feeling the pressure of this unprecedented public health crisis. Let's face it, even before the pandemic, hospitals in rural America were being stretched to their breaking points. According to the North Carolina Rural Health Research Program, 19 rural hospitals shuttered last year. That's the most since 2005, when the program started tracking closures.
This is Bruce Parker. I have practiced emergency medicine in rural America for over 40 years. All facilities are preparing for this to some degree. None of the preparations are adequate for a worst-case scenario. Much of rural America has no ICU bed availability.
Like in major U.S. cities, almost all rural hospitals are canceling elective and non-emergency services to help prevent the spread of the disease. But for many rural hospitals, those elective procedures are a critical source of revenue. Those procedures help these hospitals make ends meet. And without government intervention, some of these hospitals may shutter before the pandemic ends. For more on this, we turn to Brock Slabaugh. He's Senior Vice President for Member Services at the National Rural Health Association. He's been in contact with hospitals across rural America, and I asked him about the effects of canceling elective procedures for those rural hospitals.
Well, it means that we have a lot of hospitals in rural areas that are sitting empty, and this is creating some serious strains on finances as we move ahead into this pandemic response. I can tell you a lot of my administrator colleagues around the country are quite nervous about that, especially as we look at our history regarding rural financing in general.
What is it about the history that concerns you the most?
Well, before Corona, we came into this with a significant problem of financing our rural hospital infrastructure. So, for example, 126 hospitals since 2010 have actually closed. In many states around the country, we have 47% of rural hospitals that are losing money on their operations at the moment. These are not conditions that you would expect to be healthy as we prepare for this kind of crisis.
But do you think that these elective procedures, were they effectively filling the gap? And if so, what procedures are we talking about?
We're looking at things like colonoscopies. If you have joint replacement surgeries, those could be delayed. There's other kinds of optional surgeries that could be put off without undue harm to the patient. The problem and the reason for it is, of course, they're doing the right thing. Obviously, we don't want patients circulating in our hospital environments who are already with a chronic condition or elderly and take a chance of them contracting this potentially deadly virus.
So before this pandemic, was there a lot of investment in local and state public health departments beforehand for these hospitals?
Unfortunately, Duarte, we've been spending the last 10 to 20 years essentially deconstructing our public health resources in rural areas in bad economic times and in good economic times. And so now we see around the country a public health workforce that is not adequately staffed either to be able to meet the challenges that they're facing with this pandemic.
Now, there's been a growing conversation about opportunities for telemedicine to help fill these healthcare gaps. Are we seeing this used in rural communities to address COVID-19?
Absolutely. We are noticing a huge interest in applying telemedicine and telehealth. The problem is, and what we're dealing with in this third round of spending bill that Congress is considering in response to the COVID-19 outbreak, rural health clinics and federally qualified health centers are unable to take advantage of the important telehealth payment programs that Medicare offers.
One of the critical elements of using telemedicine is a stable broadband and internet connectivity. Do we always have that in these rural communities?
So it is kind of a patchwork around the country, and we do definitely need to spend a lot of time and resources, much like we did in the 30s and such with rural electrification and rural telephone service. We at NRHA, the National Rural Health Association, look at this as much the same way.
Before the panic, was anything being done on the federal level to address the rural health care crisis?
We've had a lot of senators and representatives that have joined us in this fight. Unfortunately, these are systemic inequities that have been built into the system for decades and decades, and it's really hard to penetrate when systems are in place that really perpetuate inequities down the road. And so we've been, singing the chorus of trying to rectify these payment inequities that have really harmed rural providers over decades.
So what should federal and state governments be doing right now to address the potential spread of COVID-19, in particular in rural communities?
Well, I think that we need to first and foremost stabilize the facilities that are really the outposts in rural areas for our patients in their greatest time of need. The stabilization, we're working in Congress now to get emergency dollars to our rural hospitals and clinics so that they can make sure that they're open. I mean, with this decrease in volume from no elective or non-emergent procedures, we're seeing cash flow drying up, and it would be terrible to see hospitals looking at bankruptcy because they're getting ready for this crisis. One of the big areas that we need to focus on for our members and for those in the providers in rural areas is personal protective equipment. I'm getting email after email each an hour that I'm at my office desk, worried about the availability of personal protective equipment and keeping our healthcare workers safe from harm. That is such an important thing that we need to be paying extra special attention to.
The challenge is so severe. Thank you so much. Brock Slabaugh is the Senior Vice President for Member Services at the National Rural Health Association. Brock, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Giraldino. As COVID-19 spreads and new policies go into effect, your life is changing. Just think about some of the things that you're already missing. Gatherings and celebrations with family and friends, playing and watching team sports, or attending live theater or music.
This is Aaron from Wichita, Kansas. And for some of us, live music is just about a daily interaction. Luckily, there's been a surge in live streaming of performances. And while it's not ideal, every instance of this shift is a testament to our adaptability.
One example of that came over the weekend when DJ D-Nice went live from his Instagram account for a virtual party he dubbed #ClubQuarantine. The guest list was more than 100,000 strong and included everyone from the Obamas to Missy Elliott to Mark Zuckerberg. But this time is also making many of us pause to appreciate smaller daily interactions, you know, the stuff that makes life rich. We ask you to share some of yours and to give a shout out to those faces and experiences you miss the most.
I miss my friends over at Trader Joe's, from the guys out in the parking lot who are collecting the carts, to the people inside who are always friendly, to getting a free sample, coffee, and talking to people I don't even know in the store. This is Barbara. I live in San Jose.
Hi, this is Kira from Jacksonville, Florida. We are missing our normal haircuts and Martha, who does our hair. And we were supposed to see her today, but we are not, to keep both ourselves and her healthy. But we miss her and her salon, and we can't wait to see you when all of this is over. You'll make us look fabulous. Thanks, Martha.
Hi, this is Kim from fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. I miss interacting with my casino peeps. I'm a health inspector, so I get to go into restaurants and food establishments and beautiful kitchens, and I miss seeing the executive steward and the executive chefs and the room chefs and all these amazing casinos in Las Vegas. And I just want to let them know Monica and Chef Armando and Rafael, how much I miss you, and I hope you're well.
Hi, my name is Cindy from Fulton, Washington, and I would like to give a shout out to Bud and Gary at my favorite Indian restaurant, India Palace in Woodinville. I miss you guys terribly, desperately. I need a tikka masala fix. Hang in there.
Hi, I'm in Eugene, Oregon, and I am in my home being isolated. I miss going to brunch with my friends and the waiters and waitresses that smile and come up and talk to me each day. I miss going over and talking to my neighbor's children and playing with them. There are so many things that we take for granted.
Hi, this is Doug Chadwick from Denton, Texas, and I want to give a shout out to all the teachers and staff and aides and bus drivers and food service folks and everybody in the Denton Independent School District who is doing everything they can to keep education and life itself going for our families and kids in our district. Good job, y'all. Keep it up.
Speaking of schools, any kids or teens listening out there? Well, as you're about to hear, your teachers and others working in educational settings, well, they really miss seeing you too.
Hi, this is Rick Harwood from Seattle, Washington. I really miss the students and staff at Foster High School in Tukwila, Washington. I'm the principal, and it's not the same to communicate by email and Zoom. Really miss all you guys. Hope you're doing well. Hang in there, and hope to see you soon.
I miss my art students. I miss their joy and creativity. AJ, Omaha, Nebraska.
Keep sharing your thoughts with us. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. As calls to self-quarantine become more frequent, many of us around the U.S. are seeing our day-to-day lives shift in big ways. But for one especially vulnerable group of us here in the USA, state-imposed mandates are harder to follow. On any given night, there are more than 500,000 people in the U.S. who are experiencing homelessness. COVID-19's rapid acceleration is putting more pressure on homeless shelters. It's also forcing many people to make hard decisions. A couple of weeks back, we spoke with Allison Eisinger. She's executive director of the Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness. Today, we're checking in on her to see how things are progressing. Allison, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you so much, Dorte.
So give us a quick update. How are people experiencing homelessness doing during this outbreak over there in Seattle?
Well, I have to tell you, our shelter system in Seattle and King County and really across the nation, it's inadequate. And that was our starting point. There are so many good shelters and other support programs that are operating, but in our community, we have the same number of people outside as we do in our shelters. So we're starting from a place where we weren't even able to give 6,000 people every day and night the basics. And then we closed the public libraries and the community centers for very sound reasons, but we did it without making sure that the supports were in place. And when you walk in the downtown part of Seattle where my office is, you essentially see that there is no one left outside except the people who have literally been left outside. And they don't have a place to wash their hands or relieve themselves or rest. And it's about to start raining for the week.
How is social distancing being practiced by homeless people, and how is it affecting them there?
With so many people experiencing homelessness, I want to be careful not to group people into one monolithic category. For some people, they're aware and they're trying to figure out how they can, you know, not have three people in a tent. The meal programs that are serving meals are getting people to-go meals and usually cold food at this point. And some folks are doing the best they can. But for a lot of people, first of all, they don't have very good information about what's going on. And then, of course, the whole idea that you might shelter in place when you don't have a shelter and you don't have a place is pretty hard to comply with. So we've got really good outreach teams, although those are being hit hard as those folks become sick or have exposures. But they're going out and they're trying to give people sanitation and hygiene supplies, water, food, medication. There are people who are working really hard to try to ensure that people are able to take care of themselves, even if they haven't got a shelter space. And then, of course, we're trying to rapidly increase and staff the number of safe places where folks experiencing homelessness can be.
So are organizations that deal with the homeless population being given any extra funding to deal with this crisis right now?
Yes, and it's not enough. Our State Department of Commerce, which is the lead state agency, rapidly released $30 million last Monday to the state of Washington to be distributed through counties. But a lot of that money went to setting up the isolation and quarantine facilities. And then when you've got small on the ground organizations or even bigger organizations with infrastructure, if they've got increasing numbers of their staff calling out sick or being unable to come in because they've had an exposure and are using up their PTO, or they have kids at home or other problems, what you wind up with is a situation in which it's not only a question of money, although we need that. It's not only a question of supplies, although we urgently need that, but it's also a question of people power. We need additional bodies. Capable, competent people who can help to support and keep open the programs that are on the ground. But we're starting from a deficit that's so deep because, as everybody knows, nationally, we have not done the necessary things that you would do if you were serious about intervening.
Allison Eisinger is the executive director of the Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness. Allison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dorte.
New York City gave some pretty blunt guidance on sex in the time of coronavirus this weekend. Quote, you are your safest sex partner, the Department of Health's memo read. It advised against sex with anyone outside your home. We'll be having more conversations about our changing relationship with sex because of COVID-19 in the coming weeks. But first, we want to check in on a group of people whose livelihoods are affected by the coronavirus, but who are often not mentioned, sex workers. They are hourly and shift workers, and like millions of people, many of them are facing a total loss of income because of COVID-19. Jacqueline Francis, who goes by the nickname Jack the Stripper, is a stripper, comedian, artist, and author. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Jack.
Thank you.
And Anya Zulajowski is a staff writer with Vice Canada. Anya, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Jack, let's start with you. What makes sex workers so vulnerable during a pandemic like this?
There's so many different kinds of sex workers. First of all, I'm a stripper. I've been a stripper for 10 years. And one of the things is that strippers can't apply for unemployment because we're misclassified as independent contractors when we're really employees. So that's just the start of it. And then a lot of the work that sex workers do is intimate work. And with intimacy kind of being out of the equation right now, that leaves so many sex workers out of work.
And what are you hearing from other people in the industry?
We're scared. We are trying to support each other as much as we can. There are a lot of mutual aid funds that are emerging, which is really inspiring. There's nobody more resilient than sex workers. So I have full faith that we can be there for each other and support each other. But as far as getting any kind of like unemployment or anything, that's absolutely out of the question for literally all of us. I don't know anybody who's getting any benefits.
So are people actually stopping work, or is there some clandestine activity still going on?
A lot of sex workers are moving to online platforms. A lot of sex workers are already on online platforms, which is great, but you have to have a lot of privilege to be able to access those platforms. You have to have access to a computer and Wi-Fi. And also, a lot of sex workers don't want to put their identities online. Stigma kills. So if we're outed by just trying to survive, a lot is on the line. A lot is at stake.
And you've been talking to sex workers in Canada where you're based. Tell us what you're hearing.
In Canada, we recently found out Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced a COVID-19 emergency care benefit. And so the point is to protect people who can't usually apply for EI. And so that includes gig workers, that includes freelancers. But I think it's pretty telling that sex workers are left out of, like, specifically left out, that language isn't included time and time again. And here, when I reached out to the government and the Prime Minister's office to ask if sex workers would be eligible, I did not get a direct response. I just got a blanket comment saying that they're, you know, releasing this very soon and that they'll have more to share in the coming days. But in Toronto, I mean, we're now in a state of emergency. So strip clubs are effectively shut down, you know, bars, nightclubs, all of them are. So that's a lot of income lost. I know a lot of advocacy groups in Toronto, in Montreal, have been doing a lot to make sure that sex workers remain informed and protected. But, you know, when income starts to drop, a lot of it is going to move online. So one sex worker who works part-time in Toronto and part-time in Las Vegas actually told me that while her clientele in a country like Italy is really spiking, she's also seeing a lot more competition online, and it's starting to be a little bit difficult to differentiate herself. For a lot of sex workers, I've heard that building a brand online is really hard. I spoke to one sex worker in Toronto. She's a dominatrix. She offers diversified services. So she already has an income and has a clientele base for both phone and sexting. And so that's really helped her. But for someone who's never done online work, building that brand and setting that all up, that takes time. And right now, we don't really have time.
Jack, what are some of the sex workers doing right now to get by, the ones who have seen business drop dramatically?
I know a lot of sex workers who are starting an OnlyFans account. OnlyFans is sort of like a streaming platform or a content platform where you can post adult content. And a lot of sex workers are already on platforms like Facebook and Instagram. And Instagram will actually deplatform you if you link an OnlyFans account in your bio. So it's even harder to get people to send the traffic to where you want to go, but that's what they're doing. And then another point is that mutual aid funds are emerging everywhere. So sex workers have always helped each other and supported each other in times of crisis. So there's a lot of mutual aid funds that you can donate to, and they provide emergency funds to sex workers in crisis. They've always done this, but there are way more sex workers who are in crisis, so they need more funding.
So Jack, what about the prosecution of sex work? In some places, obviously, it's a crime. Have the prosecutions slowed down, or are they ramping up in light of COVID-19?
Well, the one silver lining headline that I read was that in Baltimore, prosecutors are going to stop prosecuting drug possession and prostitution charges, because when there is a world health crisis happening, it is not up to you to criminalize people for surviving and doing what they do with their bodies, because it is their bodies and is their choice. So I will say that that is one thing that it's like, you know, when we're in a crisis, it's like, how important is it? How important is it to criminalize someone for selling services using their body and their own free will? It is not that important. It's not your business. So that was one headline that I read that lifted my spirits a little bit. And hopefully that realization that it is not important to criminalize these people is, I hope that spreads.
Anya, what about in Canada?
So I haven't heard anything about prosecution increasing or decreasing, but here too, so, you know, sex work itself is not included or is not considered a crime. However, every activity basically around sex work is, which does end up making the industry extremely unsafe, because we've seen a lot of cases actually, just even recently. Marilyn Levesque in Montreal is a sex worker who was allegedly killed in January by a repeat offender. And in that story, a lot of sex workers who I spoke with were saying that if all of the activities that includes supporting a sex worker, so that includes massage parlors, if those were decriminalized, then they'd be able to actually report to police, you know, instead of kind of maintaining everything underground. So that just continues to be a problem. But in terms of COVID-19, I haven't seen anything changing one way or another.
Anya Zulajowski is a staff writer with Vice Canada, and Jacqueline Francis, also known as Jack the Stripper, is a comedian, artist, and author. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you ever want to share your insight with us, call and leave us a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also follow me on Twitter at Duarte Giraldino. And I'm Duarte Giraldino. This is The Takeaway. Stay safe and healthy out there. Chat with you tomorrow.